Welcome to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Steve Junker. This is our weekly News Roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues from around the region, from print and digital media. Joining me this morning in our studio is Cape Cod Times reporter Ethan Genter. Good morning. Good
morning, Catherine.
Thanks.
How are you?
Thanks for coming down. Also in studio with me this morning is WCAI reporter Sarah Mizestan. Morning, Sarah.
Morning, Catherine.
Also joining us this hour will be George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, and we'll check in with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. So this hour, we're going to turn first to a sad story out of Martha's Vineyard this week. I want to bring George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times up here. He's on the phone. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Katie. Good morning, Ethan.
How are we doing, George?
So, George, I want to talk about a sad story. And, of course, that's the fire that happened at Flat Point Farm this week, killing nearly all the livestock there.
Yeah, this was a devastating fire. Happened Tuesday morning at about, the fire department got called around 5 a.m. By the time they got there in West Tisbury, the barn was fully involved. Really nothing they could do to save the farm. The barn or any of the animals. They did. They were able to spare an adjacent building. And yeah, so dozens and dozens of animals were killed in this fire.
Nearly 100.
And, yes. Chickens, sheep, lambs that had just been born recently. We had a photographer who does some freelance work for us who had just been at the farm 2 days earlier taking some, tremendous photos of these animals. So it's really touched the community in a tremendous way. I mean, it was such an outpouring after this.
I know. That's been amazing to watch, really.
Yeah, from almost the very minute, 8 a.m. that morning, people were showing up, with hay. And, all the farm's hay had been destroyed. So for the remaining animals, which there weren't many, there were three pregnant cows that were saved because they had been separated. But the farm had no hay to feed anymore. So, people showing up with, heavy equipment to help the firefighters out. It was just a tremendous outpouring there. And then a GoFundMe page went up within a few hours of the fire, and in 24 hours surpassed its goal of $50,000. And, this morning I just checked before we came on, and it's well over $70,000 now.
Wow. So a lot of generosity there.
A lot of generosity and, a lot of really thoughtful comments.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you just scroll through the list of people, it's people, giving $5 or, one anonymous donor gave $10,000.
I saw that. Unbelievable.
Incredible, mm-hmm. that people would come together in such a way to really help people out in who are devastated.
Right.
And I also noticed that there was a comment on there by Albert Fisher, who started this. It's his family's farm.
That's right.
That was destroyed in this. And he says the love and support of the community is beyond amazing. And, you can't put it any better than that. It's just been.
That's right.
It's been really uplifting, when something like this happens.
And, of course, that's not the only thing that folks are doing on the island. There's a fundraiser coming up by being organized by the president of the Martha's Vineyard Agricultural Society, who's hoping also to do a barn raising. So there really is a lot of effort to help them not just get through it, but to actually be able to get back to farming, which is truly amazing.
That's right. And, this is a long-time farm. It's a place where, people have gotten married, because that's a big thing here is, people love to come to this island and get married, get engaged. And they often do it at places like the Ag Hall or farms like Flat Point Farm, just to, be in that beautiful, beautiful space. So, it's just touched people on and off the island.
That's right. Well, briefly, I want to turn to one more story in the Vineyard Times this week, and that's a profile that actually you did. You sat down with a longtime Tisbury selectman who's decided he's not going to run for re-election anymore. Just briefly, George.
Yeah, this is Tristan Israel. He's been on the Board of Selectmen for 24 years. And, you know, I've only been here a couple of years as the editor here, but I had talked to Tristan when I was a reporter for the Cape Cod Times as well. And he's always one of those guys, all you have to really do is ask him one question and you're off and running. And you never know where it's really going to end. I just had a great time, you know, spending an hour with him. I wish it could have been 5 or 6 hours. He's got all kinds of stories. I hope people enjoy this profile. One other cool thing we did actually in the print edition is we took all the people that he had served with in that 24 years and put it into one of those word clouds. So
oh,
it's
wow.
Interesting too. Oh, it's a lot of people.
Yeah, I imagine. That's a lot of time to serve your community the way Tristan Israel has. And that story, of course, is available online and in the paper. That's news editor George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks, George. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much, Katie. Take care. Have a good weekend.
With me in studio is Ethan Genter, a reporter from the Cape Cod Times, and WCAI's reporter Sarah Mizestan. I want to turn now to take a look at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant. It's often a story that is in the news, people following it around the region very closely. The company wants... the company that wants to buy Pilgrim, Holtec, met with the Nuclear Decommissioning Citizens Advisory Panel this week. You were there, Sarah. It seems that their big ask was for more transparency. Is this advisory panel going to get it?
Seems like at this point, probably no. Holtec repeatedly mentioned at the meeting that up until this point, they had been focusing on just trying to settle the sale, not on what their plans for the site and the future of the site would be, something that Chairman Sean Mullen found appalling. He says, given that the plant is just a little under 3 months out from official closure. Mm-hmm. So at this point, Holtec is keeping their lips sealed if they do have future plans.
Yeah, and it looks, too, that people are getting frustrated because they have real questions and they have some concerns. One of those concerns being that, you know, is Holtec going to make any money? What's their reasoning for taking on a project that is so complicated and has some dangerous elements?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, excuse me, one important thing that came out of this meeting was that Holtec will absolutely be making a profit. That is probably the only reason that they are in the business of decommissioning plants is because there is money to be made, they say. It was a competitive bid process, Entergy said, for choosing a company that would be decommissioning the plant. And so they say that they can decommission this plant with money to spare from the decommissioning fund. And then, of course, whatever's left there will be their profit. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of watchdogs have stated that they're concerned about this because that in their running of the numbers, they don't think that this over $1 billion set aside for decommissioning is fully going to cover the cost. And so they're kind of curious, where is that excess money coming from? And they've repeatedly asked Holtec that. Holtec couldn't really answer with how much money they thought decommissioning would cost them. And of course, just something to note is that all of this money in the decommissioning fund is coming from ratepayers' pocketbooks.
Right. And that's something that the Cape Cod Times has also mentioned this week. There's also some concerns from watchdogs about the land itself, people wanting answers. What would Holtec do? It's something like 1,500 acres there in Plymouth. Would they give it back to the town? And not much of an answer there either, right?
Yeah, Holtec has said they don't have anything firm about its plans for the future of the site yet. Of course, the town of Plymouth would like to have that land rehabilitated and given back to them. They've mentioned wanting to repurpose it for a park or condominiums, possibly, since it is on the edge of Cape Cod Bay. It's beautiful. But yeah, Holtec at this point has said they are just focusing on finalizing this sale, and so they don't have any plans right now.
And Ethan Genter of the Cape Cod Times, we did hear this week that one thing Holtec is willing to say, and Pilgrim's owner Entergy, and that's that they don't want the state, which has some concerns, and watchdog groups to intervene in the sales agreement that they've got going on.
Yeah, they've asked the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, right? They asked them to reject requests to kind of intervene on that behalf. The whole process, if Entergy does it, they say it's going to take about 60 years Holtec says it's going to take them about 8. So obviously that's kind of a huge difference in numbers there. And a lot of people are worried, and more Healy is trying to step in and say, let's take another look at this. I think, what did she say? We're intervening to protect the public and ensure the transaction does not leave our state taxpayers on the hook for any costs.
Right. There's that same concern that Sarah was just talking about. I mean, there's a lot of unanswered questions here, and I think it goes back to that core thing that there's a need or a desire for transparency, and with perhaps the way that federal regulations are, there may not be that transparency that some citizens and state officials desire, because there is a protocol in place that Entergy and Holtec say they're complying with.
Yep. And then this is all still kind of ongoing. Obviously, this is going to take years. Holtec, what Sarah was saying before, Holtec is saying they're gonna have like about 3.6 million to spare maybe at the end of this kind of whole process of decommissioning. So it's still all time.
Yeah.
The range we've seen of what's going to happen here.
Yeah, and 3.6 million on the outset might sound like a lot, but when you're thinking about the fact that there's $1 billion in the decommissioning fund, and then, of course, the federal government has like $40 billion that can't all be used here, but that could help. 3.6 million left over, it's not a lot, and I know there's concerns out there that if there are some unforeseen circumstances, it could eat into that profit margin. So a lot of outstanding questions. I'm sure we're going to be talking about this a lot more in the coming weeks. Sarah Mises Tan, our WCAI reporter, thanks a lot for coming in. I know you got to get out and you're going to another story.
Thanks so much, Catherine.
Let's turn to a story, Ethan, out of Yarmouth. Selectmen there say they support a new funding agreement for the regional school district. There's been some controversy over that. With Yarmouth saying they don't like the way in which they approved funding for the schools. So let's talk about this new agreement. It took about a month to get it together. What did Selectmen like about it?
Regional schools, there's always some pulling on both sides here about what people pay and what people don't pay. On this one, to the Yarmouth Board of Selectmen, just earlier this week, they voted unanimously. They were saying they like this new proposal, which still has to go through a bunch more steps, has to be approved by both Dennis and Yarmouth Town Meeting. But basically, it kind of sways things financially more in their favor than currently. It would split construction costs for new regional schools at 65% to Yarmouth and 35% to Dennis, which is not as much as they pay now. So it's one of the things, Yarmouth feels like they're getting the short end of the stick on a lot of these issues.
Yeah.
This has all kind of come to head over plans over a new middle school.
Right.
Which
hangs in the balance because state funding is a big piece of this and there's a deadline for that. So I think they've been trying to work through this fast, but this also needs to be approved by town meeting in both towns. And those aren't, I think, until May.
Yeah, there's kind of a gap in between when they would have to drop the lawsuit. There's a lawsuit currently ongoing. And so the Mass School Building Authority has said, which is the one who would be supplying money for this school, they have basically said, we don't want any part of a project where there's a lawsuit or anything involved, any real contention. Everybody has to be on board. Where their deadline is before when this proposal would have to be approved at town meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So there is going to have to be a leap of faith a little bit somewhere. People are going to have to kind of handshake this out. We'll see if that actually happens.
Right. And I know the state has said they'd be willing to consider an extension if both sides show that they are, you know, in good faith working toward a real resolution. Of course, nothing's perfect. And as Yarmouth Selectman said, they approve of this. There was a couple pieces in it that they didn't like.
Yeah, there was no thing for arbitration or recall of members. I believe it was on the school committee. That's one of the things. There, one member said it was arbitrary and whimsical, the proposal. They did approve it. I think they kind of said it was a take it or leave it kind of proposition. So I think they said we can deal with this. It's better than what we currently have.
Right.
So, yeah, they aren't super on board with this, but they're on board as better than what they got.
Yeah, and it's interesting that there was some concern that. While it does update this original proposal, and that it gradually increases costs, that I noticed that one thing that kind of was sticking in their craw was this not really a mechanism to resolve disputes. And what has prompted this is the fact that there has been this big dispute over, you know, this tens of millions of dollars in line to pay for a new school.
Yeah, exactly. That's that arbitration piece. And they also wanted the ability to look this over like a 3 to 5 year term. So we'll see what happens. Yeah,
that's
it's still
right.
Yeah. And I mean, part of the other pieces on it, the proposal would also take a new approach to dividing the operating costs.
Yeah.
Which a lot of regional schools do it by number of students. So it kind of that again kind of sways back in Yarmouth's favor a little bit, who does have the larger amount of students in this district.
Another story we will be following. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking more local news on the News Roundup. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point, and we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Catherine Ident, and here in studio with me is Cape Cod Times reporter Ethan Genter. Also on the phone right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks.
So the historic Monomoy Lighthouse and the Keeper's House now has solar panels, and that is a big deal for several reasons.
Sure. The Keeper's House and the lighthouse out on the tip of South Monomoy Island, there's been a project over the past several years to renovate those facilities. And just over the past few months, they've installed 16 solar panels, which provide about a little over 4,000 watts of power to the building, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. And, of course, it's part of the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge down there and is overseen by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Now, the Keeper's House, which was built in 1849, it's used in the winter by seal researchers who base their operations there. And in the summer, there are other scientists who use the building. And previously, they were kept warm by using propane heat, which isn't the best out there. It's pretty remote and can get pretty brutal out there in the winter, especially. But now, for the first time in history, the building has overhead lights. It's got outlets and heat that can stay on throughout the year, and that will help keep the structure dry, reduce mold, and it's safer, obviously, than propane, said Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge manager Matt Hillman. And he said the solar panels were installed by a combination of donated labor and monetary donations from several area companies and the Friends of the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge. And, as I said, the building's been upgraded bit by bit since about 2010, and that work is nearly complete. And the refuge will be giving free tours of the Keeper's House and the Lighthouse during Chatham's History Weekend, which is in June. And as a kind of an aside, they're going to be transporting people over there on a new 38-foot landing craft that they've recently acquired, which they also used to bring over some of the equipment, the solar panels and other equipment to work on the structure. That landing craft is a regional resource, said Matt Hillman, which will be shared by other wildlife refuges in the area, as well as local communities. It was recently used by Falmouth to transport some 10,000 seed oysters. Now, unfortunately, the newly available power out there won't be extended to the cast iron lighthouse, the historic lighthouse. That's going to remain just a landmark that's visible in the daytime only. They're not ready to recommission that, I guess, according to Matt Hillman.
Mm. Well, that certainly sounds like a historic kind of moment for a place that really is steeped in history. I imagine there'll be a lot of excitement to go out there, check it out on that new boat when we finally have some nice weather around this region.
Sure.
Okay, and just briefly, a Harwichport Church parishioners there do not want a nearby restaurant to get a liquor license.
Sure. The parishioners of the Pilgrim Congregational Church in Harwichport protested the liquor license request by Capeside Kitchen, which is a breakfast and lunch menu restaurant, which is located really right next door to the church. And they, the owners of the restaurant said they're interested in being able to serve alcohol at events like weddings or after funeral gatherings that might be associated with the church. But the church was not happy with having a liquor license right next door. They're worried about the parking lot, which they share with the restaurant, as well as just the whole idea of having a liquor served right next door. Restaurant owners said they have no intention of making it a bar, but they just wanted that option. And last Monday, the Board of Selectmen decided that they would grant that permit, but however, in a concession to the parishioners, they put a condition on the license that prohibited alcohol sales on Sundays.
Mm. So a little bit of a compromise there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in the past, just briefly, the state law prohibited liquor licenses that close to restaurants, but they since changed that and made it up to the discretion of the selectmen. In this case, the selectmen overall didn't see a detriment to the community there.
Right. That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks so much for checking in with us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Catherine. You too.
With me in studio here is Cape Cod Times reporter Ethan Genter. Ethan, we heard this week that federal lawmakers intend to fast-track a bill that would protect the Mashpee Wampanoag tribal land. And, of course, this has been an ongoing story with quite a few obstacles placed in the way of the tribe in keeping land that had been set aside for them.
Yep, so that land is over in Taunton. And this bill would end ongoing litigation with the tribe, their reservation land, and reaffirm the land and bar any legal challenges in the future. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty big deal for them. They are trying to build a casino over there, which has always been kind of the big goal at the moment. And it's causing a lot of issues. The Interior Department has kind of flip-flopped on this. Mm-hmm. A judge has ruled against this reservation land. And it all kind of centers around the when the federal government had done this, what was it called? It was the Indian Reorganization Act in mm-hmm. 1934, and it was kind of all when this tribe was recognized. So it's a whole big issue, and it's kind of a big, long, ongoing thing. But this latest development, Bill Keating, our congressman down here, he had reintroduced the bill early this January, and he hopes the House of Representatives are hoping to fast-track this bill. And basically, right now, the House is in a suspension of rules scenario.
So that kind of kicks in some special stipulations for this bill.
Yeah, so what it would do, it would allow them, it would require a two-thirds supermajority of vote of lawmakers present, which I believe is different than the normal passage. And they're also limited to only 40 minutes of debate, and it can't be amended. So this kind of gives you a chance to, if this bill is exactly what you want, this kind of gives you a chance to kind of really get this the tracks greased and get the wheels going.
That's right. And this, of course, Bill Keating put this up before in the last session. It didn't go as far as he had hoped, but he has talked about the fact that he has bipartisan support, and he thinks that this has a much better chance. And, of course, the land is both in Mashpee, where the tribe's government headquarters and many people live, and also in Taunton, where that proposed casino would be built. But, of course, also this week there was news that, and there has been news over the past few weeks, of turmoil within the tribe and the government itself. And this week the stories were about an attempt to expel some members of the tribal council. So what happened and what's the latest?
Yeah, so I mean, all of this reservation land is situation is all kind of going with a backdrop. Like you said, there's a lot of things going on internally with the tribe. Our reporter Tanner Stenning has been talking to a lot of members. And so there was a chance to expel some members of the tribal council, which is the kind of government agency for the whole tribe. And during this expulsion hearing, they tried to take it into executive session, where executive session is public's not allowed to listen, no one's allowed to watch. The tribe, it should be noted, is a totally different nation.
Mm-hmm.
So they their rules on how things work are different than the U.S. and a lot of other countries. So there is different rules, but so they tried to go into executive session here. But about 30 or 40 tribe members who were in the room at the time refused to leave, which is a pretty stunning thing. One member said they stood their ground. Another said they tried to take their vote away in this whole situation. The expulsion hearing ended up not going forward. No one was expelled. No, I don't believe any action was actually taken. But yeah, it was a very emotional thing. People were crying. So yeah, it's an ongoing thing. I believe Thursday night there may have also been another hearing. I think we're checking in on that, and possibly there's one today as well.
Right. There's three people that have been that are at risk, and they're fairly newly elected people. And at least one of them, Carlton Hendricks Jr., who was the first to have a hearing this week, said that he felt that these allegations were baseless, and he felt that he was being retaliated against.
Yeah, and they were lodged against him by the treasurer of the tribe. Like you said, they called him frivolous and kind of, retaliation. He was accused of inciting a riot and breaking rules of decorum, so not just little slaps on the wrist. Yeah, they're pretty big charges, but he's obviously maintaining his innocence here.
Mm-hmm. And so we'll be, of course, watching to see, as you said, usually the public, meaning the press and folks who are not part of the tribe, are not necessarily allowed into these meetings. So it's something that the paper does to look into after the fact.
Yep.
So we'll be watching for that. I want to turn now to news out of Nantucket. I've got Josh Balling on the phone from the Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, the school superintendent was going to step away after years on the job, but is now going to return and help mentor a deputy to help take his place.
He will. Michael Kozort, who has been the school superintendent on Nantucket for the last 9 years, back in the fall announced that he'd be retiring at the end of this school year, and that prompted a search by the school committee, a nationwide search for his replacement. But this week he said he will be returning for one more year to mentor a deputy who will eventually take his place in July of 2020. This comes after the committee was unable to decide on one of three finalists after the choice of three of the members withdrew his name for consideration the day a decision was expected to be made. School officials haven't released the deputy superintendent's name, saying the contract is still being finalized. But this week, Superintendent Kozort said that the committee found one of the three remaining candidates to have great promise. They felt like they still needed some seasoning, though, and some experience in certain areas, so they asked him to come back, work for another year, advising and mentoring the deputy in some of those areas, and then they would take over for Mr. Kozort when he retires next July instead of this July.
Wow. Well, that's, I imagine, quite a bit of a mind shift for someone who is ready to go, but then, feels the sense of duty of service to continue on for another year.
I think it is, yeah. He is ready to go, but he feels a commitment to the school system, he said, and it will put the schools in a good place moving forward for 5 to 15 years or so if they work it this way. And then they also, this deputy superintendent position does not exist as of yet. The school mm-hmm. committee voted to create one, so there will now be a deputy superintendent as well as a superintendent for the schools moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And other news, this is kind of a saga, and that's that an appeals court has sent a controversial barn move proposal, which is just outside the downtown, back for review for further consideration.
They have. This is quite an ongoing saga. It goes back 5 years or more, and it involves a barn that's, again, just outside the historic downtown area on a piece of property that's proposed to be developed. And the state appeals court sent it back to the Historic District Commission for further review. They overturned a Superior Court decision. They ruled that the Nantucket officials took inconsistent positions regarding the historical significance of the barn. The barn itself was built in the 1970s, so it's not the building itself that's at issue, but how it fits into the historic character of the neighborhood. A group of neighbors who have opposed the move say it is of historic nature, the entire area, and they don't want to see it moved and replaced with new homes. The Historic District Commission in 2014 initially denied the barn move, saying it did contribute to the historic character of the neighborhood. The developer appealed to the select board, which sent it back to the HDC for consideration. The HDC at that time, with new members sitting, voted in a split vote 3-2 to allow the barn to be moved. So the neighbors appealed, and it went to Superior Court. Superior Court upheld the original HDC decision, so the developer appealed to the State Appeals Court, who this week sent it back to the HDC.
So we're back kind of where we started.
Back to square one.
Oh, wow. Josh Balling of the Inquirer and Mirror. Of course, you can read this story online, ACK.net. Josh, thanks so much for talking with us, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
And with me in studio this morning is Cape Cod Times reporter Ethan Genter. I want to turn now to a completely different subject, but one we talk about a lot, and that is whales. We have a rather nice story to talk about this week about the North Atlantic right whale. And it's nice, I would say, because it's a critically endangered species. It's been on the decline. We've had a lot of kind of bad news about it. But the good news is they're back in Cape Cod Bay.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about 400 of these whales left on Earth, so
right.
it's a big worry for everybody. But they annually they kind of come from the warmer waters of Florida and Georgia, and they come up here around Cape Cod, and so they're right on schedule. They're even expecting to maybe see some calves coming up from the south. So yeah, it's a really exciting for researchers and people who have been following right whales. As you can imagine, they're really invested in trying to keep this species alive.
Yeah, and they're off Race Point as well, usually. And I know there's a lot of excitement. You can see them sometimes, and they're in some of times are in big groups. And I know researchers are looking out for mothers with calves, because in the last calving season, we didn't see any newborns. And now we have. We have, I think, 7. So they're on the lookout for that as well.
Yeah, it's around there. I mean, obviously, a population can't survive if there's no females and calves. So, I mean, you're only looking at a further decline of population if you don't have either of those two. But yeah, they've seen, I think there was 80 in a day just the other day off Herring Cove Beach up in Provincetown.
80 so, yeah. adults, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're up and around. They're in the bay. That's where they feed. There's usually a lot of nutrients out in the bay. So yeah, it's pretty exciting. Yeah, if you ever get a chance to go see whales, it's always worth it, I'd say.
Yeah.
But don't get too close.
Well, and of course, officials have been trying to react to the fact that the population has been on the decline. And one way is by instituting a slowdown zone, which we've talked about. There's been one off Nantucket because there's a group of whales there. Now there's one enacted in Cape Cod Bay. And what they've done is they're allowing for it to be flexible to kind of shift with the animals themselves, because of course, we don't know when exactly they're going to come and they're going to go. But we do have a slowdown in effect now.
Correct. Yeah. So they're, under federal law, there's a speed restriction for vessels 65 feet and longer. So that's in the bay, which is a pretty big boat in the bay,
mm-hmm.
Running from, I think, January 1st to May 15th. And off Race Point from March 1 to April 30th. As of March 9th, state authorities ordered the same speed restriction for vessels under 65 feet in the bay. And that's from March 1 to April 30th. That's to protect the whales.
Right. And, of course, a major threat to them is death by ship strike.
That's number one.
That's right. And I want to go actually back to another Nantucket story. And this is your story, Ethan. And it's the first recreational and medical marijuana dispensary for the island is going to be opening up soon, which, of course, that's notable. But I think what's also notable is the fact that the dispensary is going to be one of the few family and minority shops on the island, and I think in the state.
I believe so. I don't know off the top of my head that last fact. But yeah, I mean, since marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, you run into some real issues trying to get marijuana in Nantucket, because it's surrounded by federal waters, and you can't fly it over because that goes through FAA, another federal agency. So yeah, the Green Lady, it's called, a spin on the Gray Lady moniker over there. They are set to open. They're hoping to open by July. They just got their final license for cultivation from the Cannabis Control Commission up in the state. So now they have just planted, I think it's 750 seeds, like about 27 varieties they're hoping to have. And I talked to the chairman of the select board out there, and he said it's really all about access, because there's no other legal way for you to get marijuana on Nantucket right now except from one of these medical dispensaries. So they were really wanted to get medical, and it seems it'd be hard to run a medical dispensary out there, medical alone, without also having the recreational side of the business.
Right. So they're allowing for both. So it's kind of going to be a one-stop shop, really, because it's from start to finish, from growing to processing and then finally to sales right there.
Yep. Yeah. Because a lot of businesses, usually they do a portion of that. They don't usually go full vertical. They'll send their stuff off to a singular testing lab where that's all they do.
Mm-hmm.
And to what you brought up earlier, yeah, it's Nicole Campbell and Rupert Campbell. They are a couple from New York. They've been going, I believe they got married over at Brant Point. So Nicole, woman, obviously, and Rupert is a Jamaican-American. A lot of the early on businesses in marijuana on Massachusetts are all usually a lot of big businesses. This is pretty exciting, I think, and goes kind of with the Nantucket style.
Yeah, not a chain. And family-owned, and of course, they bring in some experience from Colorado. So they, you know, they're not just doing this as a pure blind startup, but they're actually bringing in some real experience from elsewhere. But it's going to be kind of really locally owned in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to take a break, but stay with us. We'll be right back with more stories from around the region. You're listening to the News Roundup. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Catherine Iden, in for Steve Junker. With me this morning in studio is Cape Cod Times reporter Ethan Genter. We are looking at the top news stories of the week from around the region. So I want to talk about a story that has also been the source of a lot of controversy, also maybe make people hungry and wishful for summer, and that is that an ice cream shop in the ice cream smuggler, in Dennis looks like they found a new location. And this after a kind of a dispute over where it had been for a long time.
Yeah, so they have filed an application with the Zoning Board of Appeals for a spot very close to their last spot. It's down on 6A, right around the corner of 134 in Dennis, if you know where I think it's the Tadashi Market right over there. And they're hoping to open it as a 35-seat ice cream parlor. And this has been it's a beloved by many and kind of controversial by another many.
Yes.
So yeah, it should be interesting to see what they do. The backstory on all this is that they got into a dispute so they owned the business. There was the person who owned the building that they were in, who also used to own the business. They got into a dispute over a lease. That kind of devolved into, eventually ended up in court.
Yeah.
They ruled against the ice cream smuggler. The smuggler, the business, had wanted to own the building. The owner said no. They offered him a new lease. It was kind of a very dramatic experience for all parties involved. But yeah, so they're hoping to move on. The Cape Cod Creamery is opening in the single spot that they are in, that the smuggler was at. Just further down, a little west on 6A over there in Dennis.
So some new competition, because there's an ice cream shop in where Smuggs used to be, right?
Yeah, the Cape Cod Creamery.
Right, so they'll be opening up in right down the street there, and I would imagine they've got some longtime followers. I mean, the shop originally opened in 1979.
Yeah, the smuggler, I mean, yeah, there was the Save the Smuggler campaign,
yeah.
Which kind of really railed against the building owner, me. So yeah, they definitely have a diehard following. And I mean, when they first came out, they kind of painted this new company coming in as this massive chain. It ended up being the Cape Cod Creamery, who has a couple locations. They are, I guess, a chain technically, maybe.
But local.
Yeah, definitely local. They only have two or three other locations. So yeah, it should be a lot of ice cream interesting news coming out of Dennis this summer.
That's right. I want to turn now back to the phones. We're joining us now with some news from the Outer Cape is Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Catherine.
So I want to talk about a story this week where a developer is telling officials in Wellfleet that their town can have affordable housing like some of their neighbors.
Well, that's right, and it's not exactly a developer. It's an attorney who has many years of experience in working with developers. His name is Jeff Sachs, and he's a partner with the firm of Nixon Peabody. He's got 35 years or more experience in housing, and there was a big meeting in Wellfleet on Monday when 70 or more people turned out to learn about a proposal for really what would be the biggest affordable community housing project in the town's history. Mm-hmm. This, of course, affordable housing and the lack of it is a huge problem in many communities around the country. On the Outer Cape, it's really critically urgent with so many homes that were formerly year-round residences being bought as second homes. And Wellfleet has had a number of efforts to deal with it, mostly on a small scale, one or a few units at a time. At this point, Wellfleet has the lowest percentage of affordable units of any town on the Cape, just 1.9%, where, of course, the state's goal is 10%. So the local housing partnership and housing authority in Wellfleet have been working hard on this potential project, and the town's voters will have a chance at the upcoming annual town meeting on April 22nd to vote for an article that would authorize the use of up to 6 acres of a 9-acre plot that the town owns at 95 Lawrence Road, which is right across the street from the Wellfleet Elementary School. A feasibility study has been done that suggests that it's an appropriate spot for housing. It's on town water. It's relatively level. It's within walking distance of the school, public transportation, and the town center. And a lot of people are quite excited about it.
Mm.
Jeff Sachs, this development attorney, was one of the presenters, and he gave the group some details about how this would work. The proposal is to lease the property to a developer who would it would be a long term, like 99-year lease, and the developer would be responsible for coming up with the financing. And Sachs described all the different resources, federal and state, that are available to help finance this kind of thing.
And, so really making the case, yeah.
The timing, he said, is really good for this because these grants are competitively awarded. It's usually once a year. If this gets approved at the April town meeting, potentially a developer could be ready to go by next February or March. And within, say, 3 years, possibly, people could actually be living there.
Wow.
So that was exciting news.
Yeah, really painting a picture, making a strong case. And, of course, as is the way here on the Cape, and the island's town meeting will be the decider. That's Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks so much for checking in and giving us the details on this story.
My pleasure, Katie.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
With me here in studio, Ethan Genter, a reporter from the Cape Cod Times. I want to look at some other development, and that's over in Buzzards Bay, where Bourne officials are trying to, or they'd like to ease some regulations they put in place to encourage more development in Buzzards Bay. So this Bourne officials looking at the village of Buzzards Bay, they want to revitalize, especially that Main Street area.
Yeah, so Buzzards Bay Main Street used to be the one way to get to Cape Cod. So it used to be kind of this bustling kind of place. And not so much anymore. They've been really trying to get this street really back up and running. It's right there on the canal. You have the school there.
The Academy, Mass Maritime.
Yeah, mm-hmm. MMA. And so
the train. There's a train
there's
station.
There's the train, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, they've been really trying to work hard to get this back up and running. And right now they've requested a modification to the growth incentive zone, which is a thing with the Cape Cod Commission. It basically eases things on one side, and you have to give up. So say you have more, you don't need to follow setbacks. They kind of eases a lot of the rules in that area, and tighten up rules in other parts. I believe you have to kind of give back land.
Right, or conserve land, or set it aside, yeah.
And it's been kind of hard for them, because there's not a whole lot of land to give in the other parts, so it's been kind of a struggle for them. So they're hoping to kind of get a modification, allow them to kind of ease that up again.
Right, and they've already seen some development there with the regulations, like a hotel. And so there's things happening, but it looks like, you know, and it's interesting, too, when they put this growth incentive zone in place. It's only three, I think, on the Cape, Bourne, Yarmouth, and Barnstable. I mean, you can see why they'd want to have give and take with development versus keeping the character. But now it sounds like a time where that might be too constrictive, especially with this kind of unique area that, as you said, once was really a bustling place.
Yeah, I mean, basically it comes down to Buzzards Bay. They need to take more, and they don't have a lot to give. And they're hoping to be able to have to give less to mm-hmm. be able to take.
Right. I want to go over to Sandwich now. There is a bank right in the center of town on the hill, the former Santander Bank. And town officials want to buy it and turn it into town offices. And they kind of they gave some more details this week on what they envisioned for that site.
Yeah, so their sketch of the plans kind of came out this week. The town has reached a deal to buy for the building for $2.1 million for the bank. Officials have said they're looking to spend about $4 million to get it. There are some concerns from the community. Basically, they want to consolidate all the town offices in this one building, which makes sense. If you won't have to go talk to George down the hall and he's down the street, it kind of makes things a little more difficult. There are some worries from community. I believe the Council on Aging was a little nervous about it. They were looking at that for a senior center, so there is a bit of a dispute there. And they're hoping to pay for this all from money from NRG, the energy plant over on the canal.
Right. Some money, NRG, yeah.
Some money coming from there. So they're hoping to not even have to tap any taxpayer dollars.
Right, because this isn't exactly cheap. It's a little over $2 million to buy the property, but then they have to do some significant upgrades, it looks like, change parking. Obviously, it was a bank, so they've got to make it feasible for business. For offices, and that it looks like that they think that might cost about $4 million.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you kind of, obviously, it's going to be hard to use a bank as a town hall if you just retrofit it. So yeah, they have to really kind of do some work in there.
Yeah. And the money that they get from the plant on the canal there, it's quite a bit. It's $54 million over a period of 21 years. And that's what the company pays the town in lieu of taxes for being right there on the canal.
Yeah. And they're kind of seeing this as a one-time chance to kind of do this without having to really hit people for an override, which a lot of times, anytime you get a building or land acquisition, that you start to raise taxes. So they see this as kind of a way to get in.
Mm-hmm. And make it easier for people to get their business done with the town.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Let's go down the street a ways to Dennisport, where there's some significant road work going on that a lot of people say is ultimately going to be a great thing for that stretch of Route 28. But in the meantime, some small businesses are really feeling the pinch because it's hard to get to them.
Yeah, it's a kind of grin and bear it kind of situation. You know it's going to be good in the long run. It's just kind of, it's really hard on some business right now. So this is a closure on 28 right between Upper County Road and Depot Street, which is kind of the heart of Dennisport right there. You have what, the Buc-ee's, the coffee shop. I think they said their businesses has really dropped down maybe half. You can still access all these properties through back entrances, but it's always hard if someone's going for the first time and walk through traffic. It's obviously not really there.
Right. It's kind of, they need almost like a PR campaign to let folks know we're open for business.
Yeah.
Just be a little creative with how you get to us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And heard that business is having to kind of rearrange their hours to maybe extend hours to kind of get more traffic in to make up for the loss they might have had during their regular business day.
Yeah. And the one business that said, hey, we're doing pretty okay in this, it's an appointment based business. So
right.
It's everyone. I mean, they're not getting the walkthrough traffic. So yeah, they're hoping they kind of just take it on the chin right now, and then it'll be beautiful. Improvements, I think, include they're going to reconstruct the sidewalks for ADA, American with Disabilities Act requirements. They're going to widen the road shoulder. They're going to add some stuff to accommodate bicycles, drainage, and stuff like that. So they're hoping, I think it's an $8.1 million project. So I think they're really stepping it up out there.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's going to be beautified as well. So they're not just doing some of the kind of logistical things, but they're actually putting in plantings, and there's going to be street lights and
brick walkway, some beacons. Yeah.
And so, and this is what we said at the beginning too, that, you know, while business owners are kind of might be struggling a little bit, they see that when the work is done, perhaps this will encourage more people to spend time there, especially foot traffic and bicycle traffic, which might be more encouraged to go into these shops, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like we are out of time. I want to thank reporter Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times for joining me in studio this morning. Thanks a lot, Ethan.
Thank you, Catherine.
Also joining me this hour, I want to thank George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and WCAI's own reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Steve Junker. Have a great weekend.